Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello everyone, welcome to the Red Men Originals pod. I'm Chris Pajak. This man to my right hand side is Josh Williams. Got Andy Bell and Dan Club over on the other couch. We've got an action-packed show today. You know the best thing about this podcast, right, today is that I've done the final word show this morning on the Newcastle game and I can just freely ignore all the crap stuff from the game now. We can just talk about the good stuff. We're going to talk about the red card and all that type of stuff because they're talking points. But I don't need to talk about poor player performances anymore. And we can just focus on the fun, the Darwin Nunes, the madness, the away end, the limbs that were going off and all that type of stuff. So, yeah, I'm joined, as I mentioned, by Josh Williams, who does the deep dive with us. One of the football writers at Reach PLC. I am joined by the Darwin Nunes hater number one in Andy Bell and, of course, Dan Club. So we're going to start with Andy Bell. Andy, Liverpool... Newcastle won yesterday. It was poor from us early doors, and the Trent yellow card kind of changed the game. Do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, from early doors, we were absolutely under the cosh, and you know, I was just screaming at the TV, get a foot on it. You know, you're looking at your, for example, McAllister in that situation, get your foot on it, slow it down, take some time out of the game. Obviously, you know, you can't take the mick too much for the time wasting these days, but yeah, there was the there's the goal, and there's the red card, and then there's the Trent yellow card, and you know, it's one of those things where you can't, it seems like you can't delay the play at all anymore, even if it's just to get back in position, even if it's not like a time-wasting tactic. And my only frustration with it is that it's just not consistent across the board. Some people are getting away with it some weeks, others aren't. And yet, in the end, sort of, Trent's probably quite lucky to stay on the pitch, but I think it's, you know, he should have a foul in the first place, and that's probably where the frustration comes from.
It's a harsh yellow card, and then he's probably lenient on the second, Josh. Is that about right?
Yeah, I think the first one, mate, it's frustrating because his frustration stems from the fact that he didn't get the foul, and because it's obviously a foul, isn't it? And
then,
yeah, and then on the back of that, it starts impacting his mentality towards, like, you know, throwing the ball away and stopping Anthony Gordon from instigating a counter attack. And I think even the dodgy touch for the Gordon goal, I think probably stems from the fact he's trying to get his head straight. So it's mad how much just one little referee indecision can influence the course of a match and the downfall of a player almost.
No, I think you're dead right there, mate. I think what it did as well, it buoyed their crowd. I think we actually started,
Two minutes.
I think actually the first very few minutes we were on the front foot.
Yeah, we
started really well, and I was really encouraged by that. But then that incident, the one we're talking about, changed the whole complexion of the game because the crowd was suddenly up for it. Their players were suddenly up for it, and we couldn't get a grip of it again. And Trent was very much at the heart of that in the most negative possible sense because you're right, his head wasn't straight when he got that touch wrong. He was thinking about all kinds of different things, probably thinking I'm a bit lucky to be on the pitch because as much as the first yellow card was wrong in the sense that I don't even think he threw the ball away necessarily. I think he threw it back on the pitch, really. And it should have been a foul to him in the first place. He's probably thinking, what's going on here? And by the time he's got his head straight, we're 1-0 down, he's at fault for it, and we're down to 10 men. So that moment was the catalyst for the next 10, 15 minutes, whereby we were completely gone. We were shot to bits. We were all over the place. But that, as much as we managed to regroup thereafter, that 10-15 minute spell is something we need to be able to cut out of our game. That's when you need your leaders and your McAllisters of this world to get the foot on the ball and say, right, let's calm down and go again. And we didn't feel like we had that in abundance yesterday.
Do you think there's obviously there's loads of comments on YouTube yesterday, loads of Twitter comments and stuff, Josh, about Trent Alexander-Arnold and the vice captaincy and all that type of stuff. Now, I think it's far too soon to be starting to talk about that. But one of the things that I think is important to note is you've got to keep playing at the level all the time. And Trent's made mistakes two games on the bounce now that have led to directly two goals. Do you think he's thinking about being a vice captain more than thinking about being a player at all, or is that just pie in the sky?
Yeah, I'm not sure that's a thing, to be honest. I think he's just, since he's kind of amazed at this talent at Liverpool, I think he's just shown these kind of moments of like almost poor concentration and a little bit lacking in focus, maybe a little bit lacking intensity in certain moments. And do you remember last season against Arsenal when Xhaka pushes him and then all of a sudden he transforms into a bit of a different player? And I think he's
changed the entire game that
yeah.
as well.
Yeah. So, that's kind of an example again of Trent kind of getting influenced by an isolated moment in the game and it either having a positive impact or a negative impact on his game. And but I think he's still relatively young to be wearing an armband for Liverpool. I know he's still a vice-captain, but he's 24 still, isn't he? So I think it'll come with time, hopefully, but he is one of them emotional players, I think, who he's a winner at the end of the day, and I think if it's not going his way, if something kind of goes against him a little bit, he can pull a little bit of a strop, but not in like a really negative way, just as in like he just expects the best from himself, doesn't he? And I think it's been weird seeing him do these little kind of, I mean, especially not controlling the ball in that moment, but it's just one of them, really, isn't it?
It's one of those things that's always levelled at the captains in cricket, isn't it? That they're...
I have no fucking idea.
If you tell me, sound.
If it's yeah. NFL, come over here, mate. But if it's take it fucking anywhere, I don't want to hear it.
I think, because in cricket, I think, the captains are doing so much more and have to think about so much more that actually can sort of distract from their own game. Whereas, like, Trent Alexander-Arnold's been in the leadership group for a couple of years now at Liverpool. You know, I don't think necessarily having the armband's going to distract him from his game or being the vice-captain distracted him from his game. And, there's a list of doubts that you can have around Trent Alexander-Arnold and sort of defensive position and things at times, but not being able to control the ball is not one of them that I usually have. So I'm not too worried. If those are the mistakes that Trent's making, I've every faith in him just to get that right.
One thing is, there was a lot of talk again. It's from YouTube comments, it's from Twitter comments and stuff. Sometimes it's good to address it. Dan, is like a lot of talk about Salah in the pass, and I don't think there's anything wrong with it personally.
No, nor me. I think if anything, it's a pass. It's the pass he has to make, because Gordon is essentially on the other side of Trent when he's sort of running at him initially. It's only when Trent gets his touch wrong and Gordon sort of realises that he's able to capitalise and he changes his own running angle. So I think the pass from Salah is perfectly fine. As you've kind of alluded to, you'd expect Trent to be able to control that ball and deal with it and get us moving forwards again. So no issues with Salah in that moment. And I think, like I say, Salah clearly has total faith in Trent's ability to deal with that situation, even though there was a little bit of pressure because Gordon was breathing down his neck to some respect. But like I say, there's no blame to be labelled at anybody else's door other than Trent getting it wrong. And I think Trent at that time was just, his mind was elsewhere. And that's obviously not a good thing. It's not due to the captaincy. It's just due to the incident that had gone on before. And that's something he will have to learn from, and I'm sure he will.
Josh, you look at it from, quite often take a step back and look at it. Have you watched that goal back and analysed where else Salah could have gone?
Well, I don't think it's... I agree with Dan. I think it's Trent's problem, that one. But I think in the previous game, there was a moment, wasn't there, where Virgil plays a pass to Trent and he kind of galaxy brains a little bit. There's no real need to play that pass. You can just go straight to Kanate. But he plays it into midfield. Trent's not ready to receive the ball. We get snatched, and I think there was a goal on the back of that, weren't
there? Yeah, there was, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that one was a little bit different, but this is just one of them where I think Trent should just control the ball, or even if he can't control the ball, just hoof it then. You know what I mean? Just get rid of
the ball.
Yeah, touch the ball
anyway.
Yeah, just don't provide an assist. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think he's inclined to do that, but not for the opposition.
And then obviously the worst thing about that goal for me was the fact that it's Anthony Gordon. And he starts touching the fucking badge, and he's been there like 6 days or something. I don't know. He's not been there long. He was supposed to have been a Liverpool fan. He was supposed to have been an Everton fan, and now he's touching the Newcastle badge because he scored against us. Has this man got no respect for himself?
It seems as if he's no respect for Everton either, which is, absolutely fine. If we can win the game and he can do that and wind them up a little bit as well, I'm totally fine with that. But yeah. I mean, he has a decent enough game yesterday, actually. A lot of people don't like him, obviously, as a sort of on a personal level. But I think he is actually quite a decent winger. He's got pace, he's got trickery, and when he gets a run at fullbacks, he can be dangerous. Obviously, there's a lot he still needs to work on in his game, and numbers being one of them. But it's just one of the things on Trent. I think the thing we forget is, for all of his life, for all of his senior footballing career at Liverpool. He's been receiving the ball in the same position, sort of out wide, either on the wing in an attacking position or coming from Virgil. And, you know, your touch is sort of get it out of your feet and maybe go up the line or maybe come in field. And all of a sudden, he's just receiving the ball in so many different positions that he's never really received it in before. And I think that's playing on his mind. The touch is different. Your awareness has to be different. It's more difficult, I think, to receive the ball. And, you know, there will just be an adjustment period for him because he's still only played, less than 20 games in this in this role for Liverpool.
Yeah, it's true that actually, isn't it? And I think the knock-on impact of that decision for the referee to send the give him a yellow card early doors, Dan, is he can't really put a foot in on Gordon all game. And then there's the question of, he gets ripped time and time again by Gordon, and Joe Linton goes past him at times, and Almiron should score from one of those opportunities where he skies it over the bar, and in the words of John Bradley, commentator, he couldn't have skied it any higher. excellent, excellent stuff from the Liverpool commentator, by the way. But I think what I'm trying to get at is he waiting for his mates to come and help him out here and try and guide people inside Trent when Gordon's there, or is he just not close enough to get a tackle in, and is that yellow card playing on his mind?
But the yellow card is definitely a factor, because he knows, especially after he gets away with the second one, which I think we're all pretty much in agreement with, he should have probably got booked for that. Had he not been booked for the first one, that's a blatant yellow, because his arm goes across, stops Gordon getting away from him. So that has to be on his mind. And I think taking your player inside depends on who they are, doesn't it, in many senses. Like, if it's Arjen Robben, for instance, on the other side, and you're letting him on his left foot, that's the last thing you need. But when it's Anthony Gordon, you're probably thinking, okay, and there's a couple of times he does cut in and he has a go with his right, and there's a couple of decent efforts, because to touch on Andy's point, I think he had a really good game. I don't like admitting it because I can't stand him, but he was brilliant yesterday. So I guess allowing your winger to come inside where your mates are and where your teammates are is obviously the best option, all that, especially when you know you can't dive in, because Trent would have known if he mistimed anything, he's gone, he's walking, and we're down to nine and it's catastrophic, and suddenly your captain's gone and the lad who's got the armband's gone as well. It's just a nightmarish situation. So I actually think, although you're right to say that Trent did get done a few times, but that's almost to be expected. I think he did about as much as he possibly could from there on out. I was relatively surprised he stayed on the pitch when we made the change. I thought Gomez to Trent could have been the option instead of Diaz, but I actually think he did okay thereafter, given the fact that the circumstances weren't in his favour by any stretch.
Yeah, Josh, we'll move on to the red card. We'll obviously all have an opinion on this one, but for you, is it a red card, and if so, why?
It's a tricky one, isn't it? I think I had no problem with it, if I'm honest. I mean, obviously I did because I'm a Liverpool fan, but in terms of it being a red, I don't think we can argue, because, for a start, the main thing for me, Virgil does a lot wrong in that situation. Yeah. And I think he gives the referee a decision to make, which is, I think in them situations, you have to own that, I think. And he's wrong side, he's lazy because he doesn't want to walk back when he wants to regain the ball immediately. He does go through his man to get the ball. And even though he's not in the box, I mean, I think it's a clear goal scoring chance, mate. I see O'Callaghan at half time saying, you can't prove that, because I didn't know what he understood.
Yeah, no, I didn't get that.
What was he saying?
He said, because you
the you action. Know what his touch is going to be, do you? Don't know what Isak's going to do.
Yeah, you didn't really know what he was going to do, so you couldn't prove definitively that it was a clear goal scoring opportunity. But, I mean, there was a through ball that's going into the box. Isak's running onto it.
A case of beyond reasonable doubt. I mean, what are we doing here? It's football.
AI to simulate Isak taking the shot, yeah.
So, yeah, I think it was a red. I think it was a red.
Well, what about you? If you were in front of a jury and you had to prove it beyond reasonable doubt, do you think it was a send-off?
As much as I try not to, it is a send-off for me. I think the frustration is it's quite close to being a good tackle, and on the eye it sort of looks like a good tackle, but he does catch the man first, and, you know, it's not a red card for the severity of the tackle or the force, or, you know, it's sort of been a nasty tackle. It's just he's committed a foul and it is a goal scoring opportunity. And yeah, unfortunately, when you look at it back, he does get the man first. And it looks like it shouldn't be a red card. Morally, it almost looks like it shouldn't be, because he does sort of get the ball afterwards. And, he stays on his feet and it looks quite clean. But yeah, when you actually boil it down, unfortunately, I can't make a case.
I think one small frustration I do have with it is you wouldn't always see them given. So I think in some situations, even though I thought it was a red, you would get away with that one. But I think referee wanting to play centre stage and you know, he just kind of bottled the Trent thing. And I think he wanted to almost make up for that a little bit, and it was never going to get overturned once it was given. So the only frustration I do have with it is the fact that they're not always given. Sometimes referee will just kind of allow that to go on and just ignore it almost. And I actually think, from a refereeing perspective, football perspective, fair and everything, as a referee, you should do everything you can, I think, to avoid giving a red card, because it does genuinely ruin games. And for me, a game of football...
did this one for Newcastle.
Yeah. For me, a game of football should be decided by the best team on the pitch. No referee should impact anything unless, like, he absolutely has to, do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Dan, me and you have had quite a few conversations around this today. I think the thing that I want to get into with you, probably more than anything, is we've been talking about Virgil at his best being very standoffish type of defender. We've then also, I think a lot of people have come around to, sometimes he's maybe been a little bit too standoffish. He's now been proactive in his defending, and I think a lot of people probably wanted him to be standoffish this time.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly it. And that's sort of where I've had a dilemma with it, really, because you are right. We've kind of lamented him a lot of times for being that passive, wait for the attacker to make his move before he does anything. And obviously, it's treated him well while he's been the best defender in the world. But then there were times last season, especially, I remember the Man United goal at their place when he stood off, I think it was Jadon Sancho, and Jadon Sancho just goes, all right, then, and scores. And a lot of attackers were doing that last year. They were sort of taking advantage of Virgil being that guy who just wait for them to make the move. And they were going, he'd lost that aura. He'd lost that invincibility about him, and people were just taking him on and getting some joy as well. So clearly, whatever's happened, whether he's seen that sort of those comments and he's gone, so, all right, I'll show you then, or whether it's the captaincy or whatever, he's clearly now trying to be that more proactive. I'll go and put out fires. I'll be the one to go be on the front foot and be aggressive and deal with stuff when it's coming and not wait. And he's clearly done that yesterday, because if he wins that ball cleanly, which he wins the ball but not cleanly, we're all singing from the hilltops about how brilliant a piece of defending is. He's denied, it's a last-ditch tackle, he's denied a possible goal-scoring opportunity, stopped Isak getting a shot away, etc., etc. But because he gets it wrong, all of a sudden the conversation comes back again, like, do we want him to stand a yard off Isak there and almost wait for him to make a decision and then react? I don't know. I like the firefighting Virgil van Dijk, personally. I like him being the one to go out there and say, no, I'm better than you. I'm bigger, I'm stronger, I'm more aware of what's going on, I'm more tactically astute, etc., etc. I'm going to go and win that ball off you. And he's tried to do it yesterday. Hasn't obviously worked, but I hope that doesn't mean he reverts back to being the guy that waits for attackers to move first, because that was the worst version of Virgil van Dijk last season, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right, isn't it, Josh? I think, you know, you can't just do one thing because a striker knows what you're going to do. You need to mix it up. I think in this instance, for me, to be honest with you, if he takes a different angle and his idea is to drive him wide, it wouldn't be a goal-scoring opportunity, because he would have just forced him onto his left foot and he'd have pushed him wide of the goal, and you back Alisson and Virgil to probably get it done. But equally, you can't really moan with the fact that he's tried something there, can you? I mean, where do you sit on that? Would you rather him have sat off? Obviously, hindsight and everything.
I don't know. It's difficult, that one. I think Virgil at his best was just the type of centre-half who, no matter what the situation was, he was just always in control of it. No matter what happened, no matter what kind of forward it was, no matter where the ball was on the pitch, he just governed the situation, dealt with it as calmly as possible, wasn't in a rush or anything like that, wasn't trying to prove himself. He just dealt with it and got rid of it. I think whatever version of him that was, that's what he needs to get back. I agree with Dan in the sense of, like, last season, I think he was too, like, defending with this aura thing.
Standoffish, wasn't he?
Yeah, it went a bit overload with that, I think, and I think he needs to get that balance back of, like, not overly selling yourself like he did in this moment, but also kind of, like, not being completely standing off either. You need to get that mid ground and just get back to that kind of governance situations where no matter what the attacker does, no matter where you are, no matter what you're asked to do, you're always in control, and you know your actions are almost determine what the attacker does, because you're just in control of what's going on.
Andy, pulling on something that Josh said a little bit earlier on, and that is, like, you know, maybe a few years ago, it's not a foul type of thing, and you know, you've seen them given and not given and stuff like that. I know Dan's got some strong feeling on this as well, like, but 10 years ago, is that a red card and a sending off, a red card and a free kick? Sorry,
I'm not sure. It did feel that, you know, maybe it was just because I was young and I was growing up, and how you played football was just, you know, the same as, if you get the ball, it's not a foul. It did feel a little bit more like that, you know, 10 years ago, or maybe slightly more, maybe 15, 20 years ago. But no, I can understand, you know, completely, you know, why the rule has to change if the striker does get his body across. And it's clever play by Isak as well. He's a really good striker. I think he's probably I haven't really thought about this, but probably in the top five strikers in the league, out and out strikers, I would say right now. I think he's really on that level, and he's on like the level that can really take sort of Newcastle, well, as he has done, taking them into the Champions League. So, you know, I'd be very excited if I was them. And, you know, he's big, he's strong, he's physical, he's got everything. He tortured us at Anfield last season. For a large part of that game, he was unlucky not to put them 2-0 up. And just on Virgil, he'll always play the percentages, won't he? He'll always sort of stand them up, and he'd prefer if you have a shot from a tight angle, maybe like a 0.1 or 0.15 on the XG, rather than commit and potentially, you know, double or treble the chances of that going in. And I think Dan's right. You know, last season, all of a sudden teams were actually taking the shot on, or a couple were going in. I think he lost a little bit of confidence, and lost a little bit of confidence in his body as well with the injuries. And it's a bit of a shame, because the first two games of the season, that he looks actually like the Van Dijk that we had pre-injury. Physically, I thought he had all the confidence in his body back, and you know, it's hopefully that won't change off one mistake, and hopefully the boys can pull through for him next week and get him back after the international break.
Okay, Dan, Diaz subbed off, Joe Gomez comes on. Mm-hmm. What are you thinking at the time?
I mean, one of them isn't the time. It's a really difficult call to make, that, for me. I think I would have liked to have kept Diaz on, because I think he offers, you've already seen once, he offered that real attacking threat with that direct running style. And when you are down to 10 men, you need that outlet. You need that lad who's going to be able to take the ball and carry it to their defence. And he, like I say, he's already done that amazing run. He had the shot, doesn't he? Which is a good effort, actually, from him.
And that's really... a little ball, by the way, by Soberslide, too. It was, for that one. Was, really classy.
And Diaz had a brilliant start to the season. He has it right as well. So I think he was quite unfortunate. I did wonder, because he had a knock early on. I think he hurt his groin quite early on, that he was hobbling away from. I wonder whether that played a part in that decision, and maybe we're protecting him a little bit there. But he had to do something in terms of defence. He had to get another defender on the pitch. There's no two ways about that. I've seen some people talk about the possibility of dropping Endo back into sort of the defence as well, because he's done that a lot. He's played centre-half. Maybe there was something in that. But I think Gomez for Trent and then Endo. Because obviously Trent has already been booked. He kind of got away. He's walking a tightrope by that point. Do you go Gomez for Trent? Gomez at right back, Endo centre off. I would have seen the sense in that.
Really? Yeah, I would have to be on crack to bring a new lad in who's had less than a game at centre mid to then drop him in at centre half. But you've got Joe Gomez there.
You're chasing your tail, though, aren't you, by that point anyway? No answer. No, I guess in hindsight, which is always 20/20, hindsight suggests that was the perfect answer, what he did. But I can understand the logic behind wanting to keep Diaz on the pitch. Because, like I say, when you've got Gakpo, and I'm Cody Gakpo's biggest fan, as we know, he isn't going to, as much as he can carry the ball, and he can do, he's not Diaz when it comes to that. You know what I mean? And if you keep Diaz and Salah on, your outlets are there for all to see. And then you look at Nunes as another outlet, and we're going to come on to him later. But that's what they offer. They offer that direct running, that pacing behind, all that kind of stuff. Whereas Gakpo's intelligence is his best attribute, in my opinion. Do you need his intelligence by that point? I actually don't think he had a very good game yesterday, Cody Gakpo. Therefore, it would suggest that maybe he wasn't the man for that job.
That was the only sub I thought he got wrong, Josh, to be honest with you. I thought everything else was perfect, and at the timing of the other subs were perfect as well.
Yeah, I completely agree, to be honest. I think in a situation like that, you're going to get pinned back. You need to get up pitch, and I think Diaz has got the qualities to carry the ball, and he's got 1v1. I think better 1v1 than Cody Gakpo is, so he can get you out of them situations, get you up the pitch, potentially score a goal for you. Klopp just seems really attached to Gakpo, I think. No matter what the situation is, no matter who he's got available, he finds a way to keep Gakpo on the field. And I think it does come back to the fact that he's very football intelligent and things like that. But I agree with you. In a situation like this, you need certain qualities on the pitch, and I think Diaz offered that a little bit more. But then we won the game 2-1, so I don't really bother.
The strange thing about the Diaz sub for me, and obviously, you know, as Dan says, hindsight's 20/20, and we look back at it, and on all the subs pretty much were spot on. But like, almost because we go sort of 4-4-1, I think is how you describe the formation when we go down to 10 men. And like, almost the criticism of Luis Diaz is that he's, when you look at the average position, sometimes he's too left mid rather than left wing. And then people were thinking, well, kind of get the numbers that, you know, a Sadio Mane got. So I actually thought that maybe, you know, he would suit that left midfield position perfectly. We know he grafts, we know he sort of counter-presses really well and looks like that sort of left midfield type player for us. So I actually thought he would have been perfectly suited to that. I think there's probably a point as well where, you know, what is it saying to Trent, or what's Trent's confidence levels at if you do take him off? You know, you can say to Diaz, listen, you've had a brilliant start to the season. We've had to do what we've had to do here. We've had to sacrifice an attacker, but you'll be straight back in. And that'll not knock his confidence at all, because he knows that it's nothing to do with his performance. Whereas Trent did have a bit of a stinker. You know, he did concede the goal last week. He was at fault for the goal this week. He did nearly get sent off. I did think you probably needed to persevere with him through that. But then I suppose how important is that compared to just getting the job done on the day? I'm not sure how much that actually factors in.
It's true, that, isn't it? And then obviously we go into the second half. We get to talk about the fun stuff now. Josh, Jota and Elliot come on. And for me, those were... Obviously, Darwin Nunes is the best substitution. But I think he set it up really well with the Jota and Harvey Elliott sub, and it just kind of changed the way Liverpool were playing.
Yeah, it felt like we went into that. Obviously, Klopp had a bit of time, didn't he, before we went into half-time. And it felt like in that 15-minute break, we kind of come up with like a really obvious plan, really, in terms of like just adopting this 4-4-1 or whatever it was, and kind of using the pace we've got on the break to really just get them on the break and cause problems for them on a counter-attack and stuff. And we've got the players to do that. And he just gradually introduced more and more of that in the game. And when a player was struggling physically and that, he would introduce someone in their place. And I think Harvey Elliott fed those attackers quite well in a few little moments. Jota causes problems for everyone on the break. So, yeah, I think it was just a really well-executed game plan in the end. And it's nice that we've got Klopp's always prioritised these players, hasn't he? These kind of really, really fast, tricky 1v1 merchants who are inclined to get in like dangerous positions and things like that. And this is one of them games where, despite being down to 10 men, we could really use that.
Yeah, absolutely. Just coming back to you then, Andy. Darwin Nunes is brought on. Happy with that sub?
Yeah, you know what? In all seriousness, I did want to see him at that point. You know, my issue with Nunez is sort of what game he actually plays in. You've had sort of three very different games so far. Before you actually think of how they've played out in terms of the red cards, you've had, you know, Chelsea away and Bournemouth at home, two completely different games, and he comes on as a kind of late sub in both of them. I don't even think he really particularly wants to do Nunez against Bournemouth. I think he reluctantly puts him on after, I think, Diaz is a bit of a knock. And I think that, you know, from what he's saying, it's the defending from the front and that's the issue, and that's why he can't get into the team. But there's 10 minutes to go, you know, when the game's a little bit stretched, they're panicking a little bit. That is who you want. And I can't fault those two finishes. They're absolutely sublime. It was like watching Prime Torres. I've now gone completely the other way. You know, there were two unbelievable finishes.
Don't sit on the fence here, by the way.
You know, my problem is with it, you know, in that moment, absolutely, Nunez is a sub every day of the week. But when else are you going to be 1-0 down away from home with 10 men against a decent side? It's not a game situation that rears its head very often. So, you know, as much as I think now you do definitely have to throw him in against Villa, and I think you do have to say, you know, this is your time to really show yourself and make your name for yourself and nail down a spot in this team, I'm still not convinced off yesterday that he's going to make himself first choice in Liverpool's team anytime soon.
Dan, you were upstairs watching this. Where did you end up after the second goal?
Here. I was here. Obviously, influenced that table there.
Just... I think I've seen Andy Bell do something very, very similar as well. Yeah. When Alisson scored.
Well, I was on a stream upstairs, so I was like a minute behind everyone. So I'd heard the goal before I'd seen the goal. And by the time I got down there, I got to watch it. It was amazing. It was immense. Like, what a finish, by the way. Like, for all of his, you know, his negative attributes, he does have some. To a certain extent, I agree with Andy's point. Like, when you compare him and Cody Gakpo, they're miles apart in terms of what they offer, in terms of what they can do. I mean, they're completely different footballers. They've got different X factors, different weapons. But Darwin Nunez, when the game stretched like that and there is a little bit of chaos and there's no real rhyme or reason to the tactics anymore, systems are kind of going out the window a little bit, players are tired, etc., etc., there's nobody you'd rather have on the pitch than Darwin Nunez because of his pace, his explosive power. Both of those finishes are out of the very top drawer. Like, the very, very... And they're not really... Like, he's clearly got that in his locker. He was doing it for fun in Portugal, of course, beforehand. But there were moments last year whereby he lacked the confidence to do that sort of thing. And for whatever reason, whether he wanted to prove a point, whether he wanted to show Jurgen Klopp that he is the man to be starting, because by all accounts, he was quite frustrated last week after the Bournemouth game because he only came off the bench. Whether he is trying to show everyone, look, I'm still the man, don't forget about me. Whatever it was, I want more of it, because those finishes were unnerving. They were high, high class. And to do it twice, having not started three back-to-back games, is testament to the man and testament to his attitude, because he's had a tough time, really. You get quite a bit of criticism. You can see in the celebrations how much it meant, and there's nobody I'd rather in those situations, generally speaking, I'd rather it be Jota, time and time again. But as nobody I would rather had scored them goals than Darwin Núñez yesterday. I feel like he deserved it.
Yeah, he did. It was I looked on Understat. The first one was a 4% chance, a 0.04 from the edge of the area, which is outstanding, like, isn't it? And it's the accuracy, Josh, isn't it? You know, it's the... I've seen Darwin Núñez take shots on. We've all seen Darwin Núñez take shots on. I've not seen him hit one quite that sweet before in such telling circumstances.
Yeah, it was the first one for me, you know. I think the first one was, like, in off the post, weren't it? That was, like, pinpoint precision where, like, anywhere else, really, the keeper probably gets a hand to it. So he's literally got, like, the tiniest zone ever that he's got to aim for, and he hits it to a point. Really top finishing. And the second one, I think he's got that confidence boost then. Mm-hmm. Beats the goalkeeper and that. But he is such an interesting player. I said it the other day on that deep dive, didn't I? And,
No, it wasn't called Master Plan. No, it was called Klopp's Núñez Master Plan, was it, Josh?
Which camera should have looked down when I said this?
You're quite called go 1-0 down, 10 men bring Núñez on, but I get your point regardless.
I think you can just use that element of his game, though, you know. Just keep him away from the ball, mate, and feed him in behind like that. And obviously, against the deepest of blocks, you won't always be able to do that. But if you can let him do what he's good at and keep him away from the midfield, where he's going to pick up a nosebleed and that, then I think he'll be... He can be a monster. We've seen that. He can be a real menace. But Liverpool just have to kind of manipulate the system in a way where you get the most out of him when you kind of mask his flaws almost.
The best part, though, Andy, was the wink and the kiss. Yeah. The second goal, wasn't it? I mean, that was the best part of the whole thing.
That's when my opinion changed. That's why it's now Prime Torres.
No,
that was amazing because you can hear him shouting, Bamos, Bamos, Bamos. And I think they cut the audio out because they think he's about to swear. I mean, I don't know. He doesn't seem like... I don't know if he's learned how to swear in English yet. I don't know if his English lessons are quite that advanced. But I think...
Judging by the post-match interview, yeah. Alisson conducted for 45 minutes. I reckon they are, though.
Yeah, so I think they were doing that. And then obviously the crowd behind the goal, the home fans are giving them loads of sick, and it's just like such a cold wink and a kiss, isn't it? It's just, you know,
it's heavy.
You can give loads back, or you can show you're annoyed by it, or you can just do that. It was brilliant, and you know he will the confidence will be soaring through his veins now, and to think, you know, not to get on to next week, because I know you'll be doing shows around that, but you know that's gonna be a very, very difficult game, not only the opposition, but also, you know, the fact we're going to have to do that without Virgil van Dijk, and something like Darwin Núñez, as I say, the absolute adrenaline running through his veins, and maybe just hitting the crest of a wave at the right time, scoring a couple of goals could just get us through that and get us 10 points from those first four fixtures, which we'd all have taken.
I wish we could have seen the Newcastle fans when Darwin did that. You know, I would have... How many of them would have picked the shirt up from the back of the chair and put it on and just walked out? You know what I mean? It would have been glorious. We got to see the limbs, of course, Dan, from Chloe's video. I mean, that looked like an away end, that, didn't it?
It did, mate, yeah. And you know what? Like, you know, they needed that and they deserved that, because a lot of them, including our Chloe, would have gone to a lot of away games last year. I mean, I went to a few. I went to Bournemouth and watched us get beat down there, which I mentioned every single week on this show. But they deserved that, though, generally speaking, because, like I say, they've been up and down the length and breadth of the country last year and watching some horror shows at times, quite frankly, on the road especially, because we were miles off it at Anfield last season, but especially away from home, our away record was abysmal, and they didn't have many things to celebrate, didn't have many moments like that. So to get a moment like that against the odds, when you've been down to 10 men for 70 odd minutes, whatever it is, against a Newcastle side that, you know, going into that game yesterday, a lot of people would have made them favourites, and in many respects rightfully so, because given what they did last season, even the way they've started this season, you know, taking into account the Man City game, which they didn't really get into at any point, but that's Manchester City, going there and doing that when you're down to 10 men is a moment, it's a real statement, and you could tell that by the reactions. Obviously the fans is one thing, like the scenes, that was boss, but even like the Klopp and Trent coming out afterwards and saying just how big a performance that was in sort of the annals of what Klopp's done while he's been at the club. So that is a huge line in the sand, especially for like to Darwin Núñez, of course, but some of the other lads as well, the new lads, McAllister, Szoboszlai, to be a part of a win like that is so early in Liverpool career is a big, big deal. So it just stands us in brilliant stead for what's to come. But like I say, the away fans, especially those that did pretty much every game last year, deserved and probably needed that.
Yeah. See on the point Dan makes there about them being favourites for the game, I thought that's something we kind of did quite well in terms of our game plan. We kind of just kept it tight, let the nerves, in the home crowd settle in that little bit more. They started to get a little bit edgy, and I think Newcastle, because they've had such a rise from where they came from, it was so unexpected. They still don't see themselves as like as comfortable in this, in the sort of top six and the top four. They're not comfortable being favourites in these games. They like the underdog mentality. The fans like to sort of get behind them at home and create that siege mentality. And I thought, you know, what we did really well, whether it actually came into their minds or it just sort of played out that way, is that the closer the clock ticked towards sort of 70, 80 minutes, the more they thought, okay, actually, yeah, 10 men for 70 minutes of this game, we really have to win this now. And that's when the nerve settled in. And it is a mistake for the first Nunez goal from the defender. It's a great finish, but the defender does make a mistake. I'm not sure how much that played in, but it was interesting because I did think, you know, you really are favourites now, and they would have never thought they'd been favourites at any point in a game against Liverpool if you asked them.
I think if you go back to the start of Klopp's tenure as well, we were a little bit like that, weren't we? If you think we were getting tagged as like this super intense team who little underdogs at times against like Manchester City and these possession based sides and that, and we did teams on the break all the time, and when the game was really direct and fast, we were the best in the league really. But when we were coming up against like a Palace or a West Brom, we'd slip, and it was because he was 10 behind the ball and we didn't really have the possession game to break that down really until Linders maybe started taking more of the training sessions, Trent started to evolve a little bit more, Robertson established himself. But I felt a little bit like that with Newcastle, who have been compared, I think, to Klopp's Liverpool early days a little bit in the intensity and the running power and that. But when it comes to facing a block, they had a few more issues and reminded me a little bit of us a few years ago.
That midfield, like what Brighton are doing right now as well, isn't it? West Ham, West Ham just, you know, sat back. You can do what you want with the centre halves. They can put their foot on it. We're not going to press them. You know, different phase for them
Did
now.
Did you see the David Moyes comment on that? About no. possession? Someone asked him in the press conference, they know they had X amount of possession, might be 75%. So that's all right, they can take the ball home if they want. We've got 3 points. I actually quite like that. Said, Moyes, yeah. You keep the ball.
Fucking hell, Moyes going in hard, cold from David Moyes there.
That's a great shout. That's
a good shout.
One player we've not spoken about, though, Alisson Becker, Josh.
Yeah. Oh, special, mate, honestly. I didn't actually realise at the time during the game, but I've seen in the interview after it, that's the most saves he's ever made in a Premier League game. I think that's mad. Doesn't feel like that, but even the magnitude of them saves, like the level of them and that, keeping us in the game. And I think if you've got a normal goalkeeper in that situation, you maybe end up losing 3 or 4 or something like that. He is really special. And even the way he conducts himself in the post-match interview and that, he's such a leader, isn't he? And you just got so much faith in him behind you. And it's a shame looking at the state Liverpool are currently in, not competing in the Champions League, and it remains to be seen whether we can compete for the league title this season. But when you've got a goalkeeper as special as that, you really should be trying to maximise that, because players like him don't come around very often. And when you've got someone that level, they're really capable of just delivering results, even if the performance is terrible. And Liverpool's performance is usually good. So you really need to use a goalkeeper at that level, mate, because at the past like 12 months or so, we've been relying on him rather than using him to win trophies.
So that actually, yeah, I mean, obviously a good goalkeeper gets you a lot of points over the course of a season, doesn't he? And I think he's a big part of why we were able to win such big trophies and stuff. We've got to maximise him, of course, as you say there. But I think one of the things that I want to talk about next really is go back onto Darwin Núñez a little bit, because I want to do the talk about next week, because I think it's important for us right now. Like, obviously Jürgen was asked about whether Núñez would be in his starting 11, and he was also thought pretty apt mention that, like, you know, if I started him today, he wouldn't have played so angry. And he did play angry, and obviously that's probably got an impact in him and getting his 2 goals, Andy. Like, is it as simple as he starts up front next week for you against Villa?
I think he probably does have to. I mean, you know, Jürgen's going to have a big decision to make. It'd be very, very brave to leave him on the bench again. You know, I think at that point, you know, you get an angry Núñez coming on yesterday, but I think if you leave him on the bench again, you'll just get a really frustrated and hot-headed Núñez, because, you know, he'll see that as injustice, and possibly rightly so. But what's important to mention is that, you know, how the game's going to play out against Villa at home next week is completely different to the 10 minutes in which he came into yesterday against Newcastle. You know, they're a really solid team. Unai Emery has them really, really well set up, well organised. frustrated us loads last season, frustrated us loads the season before.
Every MU side's been a struggle for us, yeah.
And he will be coming to Anfield. You know, we mentioned the mentality in Newcastle and being that sort of top six side and feeling like they have to win these games. Villa are still, as much as they're playing very well and as much as they're a good team, they're still at the point where they're coming to Anfield for a draw, and they will come for a draw. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those, you probably are going to have quite a bit of the ball, you probably are going to have chances, and probably balls are going to be falling around in the box. And I'm not sure how much a Gakpo at home to a team that sits in so much is necessarily going to be effective. Obviously Jota can help when it gets scrappy, but I just think if you are going to get chances, I think play the lad who's just banged 2-4% chances in.
Yeah, I think it's impossible to ignore him, to be honest with you. I do. My preference would remain, you sat here then thinking whilst Andy was talking, my preference would remain Cody Gakpo. It genuinely would. If I was picking my best 11, we always talk about like cup final 11, don't we? What would it be? Gakpo would be in it ahead of Nunes, in spite of what happened yesterday, really would. And I say that with the caveat that Gakpo hasn't started the season particularly well for me. But I know two of them games in midfield, which obviously isn't his preferred position. But to kind of riff off what Josh said earlier, in terms of he's clearly integral to what Jurgen Klopp sees his plans. Like, the fact he's in the side early season, ahead of like Harvey Elliott, who's played exclusively as a midfielder for quite some time now, suggests that he sees Cody Gakpo as very much a name on the team sheet, if not one of the very first ones, probably behind like Alisson, Van Dijk, Mohamed Salah, those kind of people. So I would be inclined to stick with Gakpo. However, I don't know what you do to the lad's confidence if you don't pick him. Like, we've all said how much of a confidence player he is, and I referenced this yesterday. I think last season, it was a rollercoaster ride with Darwin Nunes. It may always be that way. But he actually started the season okay. Obviously, gets his goal against Fulham, Community Shield goal as well. And then the red card against Palace sets him back weeks in his sort of bedding in period. And he never really manages to recover. He has flashes here and there, little glimpses of magic, the Real Madrid goal, for instance, a couple of moments. And you think, okay, that's great, now build on that. But he never does. Now, there's something there, yes, that he can build on. And he can only build on that by starting the next game. So I think it's a weird one. I think the sensible choice would be to pick him. Because if you don't, what message are you sending, like I say? But I think, honestly, I think if Klopp, in sort of, it depends how ruthless he wants to be. I mean, if he wants to pick his very best 11, one he believes will win that game of football, he doesn't go with Nunes.
Josh?
I think it's a really tricky one. I think the issues as to why he hasn't been playing are still there. Mm-hmm. Even if he's just scored twice, they're still there. So I think it's a tactical thing for me. I think Liverpool need to control the game more to accommodate a player as chaotic as he is. Mm-hmm. And I think if Liverpool can establish that, we can then integrate him and he'll hurt them more than he'll hurt us. But whether we can establish that against Villa without Van Dijk on the pitch, with Endo still getting to grips with the Premier League, it remains to be seen, really. I think it bodes well that I think Villa are very much an offside trap team under Emery. So that bodes well for Nunes and what he offers as a threat and behind and things like that. I think that's, you probably want that more than ever against a team like that than you do what Gakpo offers, for example.
Second choice goalkeeper's playing as well, isn't he?
You know,
So if you're playing a high line, obviously the goalkeeper's very, very crucial in that. And you know, if the second choice, is he going to be a bit hesitant? He's obviously not as good as Martinez. I think it's interesting because, like, people are saying he played Gakpo in the midfield because we had no midfielders, and there is a part of that, but I think there's a part of Jurgen Klopp that was like, I was glad I didn't have to make a decision at the start of the season between Jota and Diaz, who'd both had a brilliant pre-season. You know, and I think possibly against Philly you could see Gakpo drop back into the midfield. I don't want to see him there, but do you need an Endo type player against Villa at home? Possibly not. But then, you know, Jota comes on, does really well, so you'll want to fit him in. Diaz has to play, Salah has to play, and you want to fit Nunez in. So I think all five of them have,
one
like
thing
a,
on Salah,
really
at the back end of last season, he started to understand where Darwin was moving to. I think that was over and over again. And I think yesterday's game, Josh, he shows that again, doesn't he? I mean, it is an unbelievably good assist by Mo Salah.
Yeah.
The weight of it, the fact he threads it through three players as well. Like, they do have a bit more of an understanding. And he just seems to be, I don't know, just having something with Nunes.
Yeah, I think they've got a bit of a relationship there, haven't he? And if you think of Salah's time at Liverpool so far, he's never really had that kind of player running beyond him, has he? Like, he's always been that player, Salah, that threatened behind for Liverpool. And the player through the middle has been Bobby, who's been going the opposite way.
Mm.
So Salah's now got that player to find. And he's always had them passes in his locker. Salah, it's never really received much publicity, but he's always been able to find those players. So I think that's definitely a dynamic that's going to improve, but you know, going back to the Gakpo thing, that's again an issue with Nunes, because I think if you deploy Nunes, he only plays as the nine for me. He plays nowhere else. If he plays as the nine, I think the way in which players have started the season, especially, I think Diaz has the left locked down for now for me. Mm-hmm. That then probably means if Gakpo doesn't play in midfield, he's on the bench. Mm-hmm. Klopp doesn't seem to want him on the bench. He seems to want him on the pitch. But if you play him as an eight, in my opinion, he doesn't give you the control that you need to accommodate Nunes. So
Gakpo right back and coming, I can see it.
So it's a problem. I suppose it's a nice problem to have if you want to go back to that. Like, but tactically, it's a tricky one, because I agree with everything Dan said about Gakpo so far, in the sense of I don't think he's had the best start of the season. And I had a look at the numbers actually during the week. Playing in midfield, mate, he's averaging about 20 passes per 90, right? Curtis Jones last season in the same role was averaging 50. Mm-hmm. Szoboszlai so far on the opposite side in an identical role is averaging 50. Gakpo's down at 20, mate.
Hendo was about 57 or 58 last season, yeah, of the course, yeah, of the year as well.
You know, for Gakpo to be playing in the middle of the park as an eight like that, he's a bit of a black hole at the minute. Mm. Like, there's nothing there almost in terms of possession game.
You're right, obviously, but Klopp will be fully aware of that. And yet still, it feels like he wants him on the pitch, even if it is in that role, which just tells you how much trust, how much faith he has in him. And on the other hand, says he has a lack of, not a lack of, but sort of a lesser trust in the likes of Harvey Elliott, in the likes of Curtis Jones when he was available on the season. Like, it just shows you how much love he has for Cody Gakpo. We clearly, when he signed him last season, thought, I don't know whether they expected it, I don't know whether they have unearthed this gem, or he just came in and they all went, wow, he can do all this other stuff as well. Because when we signed him, left winger predominantly for PSV, he played a little bit as a nine. I don't think anybody really envisaged what he was going to become, or looks like he may well become. So I don't know who spotted him and who spotted the fact he could do all this other stuff, but whoever it was deserved a lot of credit. But for me now, like I say, it doesn't feel like Jurgen Klopp wants to name an 11 without Cody Gakpo's name in it.
No, I think that's right, isn't it? Go on.
Yeah, it's just Arsenal are doing a very similar thing with Havertz at the minute. And Havertz has come in for a bit of stick, because I think, you know, like Gakpo, wouldn't be surprised if the numbers were the same in terms of how many passes. Havertz is, he's looked quite anonymous in games, but there has been one or two big chances that have been created for Arsenal in their games, which have just come from Havertz picking up the ball in that area and threading a pass through. And I think one of the things they do rate about it is, even if they are on the periphery of games, your Gakpos and your Havertz is playing in the eights, when they can get a control of the ball in those attacking areas, and it's holding on to the ball in those areas, which pushes the defenders back another sort of 10-20 yards, can just be invaluable. And I just wonder if those one or two moments a game that you will get from your Gakpos and your Havertz is sort of outweighs all the other stuff. I'm not
interesting
sure.
Stuff. Before we move on to the transfer stuff, I can see people in there. Herobrine saying transfer update, please. Who's the final player joining us? Hopefully, final players joining us. That will be coming up very, very shortly. Before we get on to that, the last thing to talk about really is the character of this Liverpool side. But before we talk about the character of this Liverpool side, Josh, we need to take a moment to talk about Jason Tindall. Because I don't think you can talk about Newcastle without talking about the assistant manager of the side.
Yeah, that was actually going to be my deep dive this week. Deep dive on Jason Tindall, mate. What was that nickname that you said before we started recording?
Sunbed sausage.
Oh, he's I don't even know what to say, mate.
Why do we know who he is?
I don't know exactly. Yeah, it's a good point. I think Klopp was spot on the other week when he said this new rule is introduced for one man and one man.
Didn't stop him, because he was in the technical area asking for a yellow card for Trump, by the way, Andy, wasn't he?
Yeah. I think they're allowed to both be at the back, but they're not both allowed to be at the front. So
where are they? How's at the back?
Yeah, so literally. Are we going to need a... Well, literally, yeah, exactly. And, you know, you look at all these, you know, the team photos after games, and Jason Tindall's front and centre, and Eddie Howe's just, like, putting his arm around at the back, trying to get his face in. Yeah, I mean, you've asked
me this. It's funny, actually, because... Sorry to interrupt. We've got the only other... assistant manager, that's a big deal. like you shouldn't really know who the assistant managers are, but everyone around the league, whether you're a fan of Liverpool or not, knows Pep Linders, and everyone knows Jason Tindall.
It's funny as well, because like there's a large community now of Liverpool fans who seem to hate the fact that Linders wants the spotlight. It's like any assistant manager that wants any kind of limelight, Spurs just hate it, mate. Like, they just dive on it instantly and just make out that this fella's like self-obsessed or wants to be in the media all the time or whatever. And
but Jason Tindall genuinely
does, yeah.
It's the handshake thing for me, I can't get over it.
Oh yeah, who was the manager? Maybe it was actually Clark.
Gary O'Neill, you know.
It was Gary O'Neill, yeah. He actually, you know, rejected the handshake first and shook Eddie Howe's hand. It's just strange. I hated him before it was cool in the 2-1
before the Twitter account.
Before the Twitter account, yeah. Which I'm not behind, by the way. But
that's a Darwin Nunes one. Year,
so in the 2-1 last season when they were wasting loads and loads of time, like I could just spot him from the cop, and like he was kicking balls onto the pitch and then like throwing his arms up in the air saying there's two balls in the pitch. So I was absolutely.
So you're the one fella who googled who is Newcastle's assistant manager. No one needs to Google it anymore.
No, 100%. So yeah, it's just a. I know this is on YouTube. I don't want to swear in case any of my pupils are listening, but like it's just a weird Geordie Shore reject. Awful man.
Awful man. Okay, just the main character syndrome, isn't he? Yeah. That's all he's got. Like I find it hilarious. I think it's boss. Even yesterday when like they were both shouting instructions on, it was like Tindall was ahead of Howe. Like in the body shapes and the angles, Tindall was just slightly ahead. It's like, even that is a tiny thing, but because it's such a big deal now, that's a thing in itself. You know, I just think it's boss, mate. I think it's so funny. And he does, like, you know, we've seen Klopp doing his BT media stuff or TNT media stuff rather the other day. Tindall does all that as well. They get him involved in it. He does everything now, literally, because I think they're just playing on it. I think for a while, it was just like under the radar and he's always done it. But now, any possible given opportunity, they're making Tindall get involved. And I think it's so funny. I think it's boss.
I wouldn't want that if I was Eddie Howe, to be honest with you. I just wouldn't want him anywhere near me. Like, he just comes off like an absolute bellwiff.
No, he is,
like,
yeah.
I don't like bellwiffs, I've decided. Anyway, I've had a super chat that's got nothing to do with any of this. So Regan has sent us $4.99. Thank you so much. Salah to play deeper. Keep picking Nunes instead. A false nine and kind of play a false 11 with Sobo running deep to the right. You're the deep dive expert, Josh.
Was that Nunes' false nine, was that?
I think he's saying play Salah as the false nine, no, but from the right.
Yeah.
And let Nunes...
Play Salah as a false nine from the right.
He said false 11. But I'm trying to explain the position to you. An inverted right winger dropping deep so that Nunes has got the space in front of him.
Right, yeah. Anything that doesn't involve Nunes dropping into midfield, I'm on board with. I'll just say that. Anything that involves Nunes running in behind, sound.
Okay, I think you've answered that very, very politically correctly. Well done. And the character of the side then, Dan? What did we learn from that yesterday?
Yeah, loads, to be honest with you, mate. And it was one of them, like I kind of alluded to it earlier on. Last year, in the face of adversity, we buckled time and time again. We wilted, weren't able to show anything really, especially away from home. So to do that yesterday is a sign that we've come a long way. And I think we needed it. And it was a little bit, and you could tell from all like the captions that the players were putting out and even the post-match interviews, especially Alisson, who conducted himself brilliantly throughout them, by the way, even when he was translating the world's longest sentence into Darwin Nunes, waiting like 5 minutes just to go, yeah, he said it was sound. But yeah, I think the messages that were coming out were perfect because it was a little bit writers off at your peril type thing. And that's, I love all that. I've mentioned a few times on the show, certainly the post-match ones. I like it when our lads take offence that we might drop points. Szoboszlai did it last week against Bournemouth. He was like, what, there's this possibility we might not win this game? Nah, not happening. I love all that. Alisson did it yesterday. Obviously, Darwin Nunes did it yesterday in a huge way. And I think that's such a boss mentality to have. And we lost it last season. So to go there, and don't get me wrong, our record against Newcastle's really good, despite them being a better side than they have been for a long time. But to go there to a team that are riding the crest of a wave, just got Champions League football back for the first time in quite a number of years, and to do that when you're down to 10 men shows a hell of a lot about our character and what we've still got in that dressing room. We just lost our captain, but we're able to sort of make a sense of it for a while, kind of muddled together, I'd say, for the end of the first half. But thereafter, whatever happened in that 15 minutes in the dressing room worked a treat, because then we were organised, we were at it to a man. Szoboszlai, again, was at the heart of that, by the way. He was everywhere. His man-possessed territory. Phenomenal. But to show that type of grit, determination and desire, not to sort of succumb to the crowd, which I think we were doing all too often last season, shows a hell of a lot about where we're at. And it bodes well for this season. And the fundamental, sort of the baseline of a good Liverpool side is that running, that desire, that willingness to put it in for the badge. And that was there in abundance yesterday, so I can't really ask for a lot more.
No, that's it. Like, I mean, Andy, coming straight to you then on it, I mean, the Szoboszlai thing I want to pick up on, because two games on the bounce now where we've gone down to 10 men. He wasn't part of the mentality monsters, and yet he looks like he was born to play that role, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's a breath of fresh air. And obviously, you know, we had the mentality monsters, and we had the, you know, what was it, 27 wins out of 28, spanning over two seasons. And we had that amazing team. But then it did sort of fall apart the next season, and almost they were having to give 100% mentally every single game, that, you know, when they had a bit of a break from it and the kind of come down from it, ended up kind of working in the opposite direction. So I think it's important that we have got a couple of fresh players in here. Okay, they weren't part of the mentality monsters team, but they also weren't part of the team who lost, you know, six home games in a row during COVID, or, you know, lost 3-0 to Wolves and Brighton and Brentford away last season. You know, we've got that little breath of fresh air. And, you know, I know on another podcast we're going to talk about some of the players coming into Man City, the likes of Kovacic and Matheus Nunes, possibly, who, you know, they're very sort of specific players. They've got specific attributes which will fit well into that well-oiled machine and that cog. But Szoboszlai, and I'm not sort of making the comparison in terms of the quality of the player, but he's very Gerrard-esque in that he can do absolutely everything. He's everything in his locker. He's got the burst of pace, he's got the bit of skill, he's got the long shots, he's got the tackles, he's the physicality, he's the power. You know, I just can't wait to watch him in a Liverpool shirt this season.
Do you think he'll link up well with Prime Torres?
Fingers crossed. If Szoboszlai continues as he's going, and Nunez does indeed prove me wrong in the most hilarious way possible, I think, yeah, we'll challenge.
That's brilliant. Okay, we're going to have a very, very short break, and then I promise we are going to talk about transfers. So give us a second and we'll be right back.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome back. So we're going to talk transfers now. Josh, I'm going to start with you on this one. As a bare minimum, this week, how many players do Liverpool need to sign to put us in a very good position to challenge?
To actually challenge for the title?
Yeah.
At least two, I think. I think you need another centre mid. I know the line has been like a multifunctional player, but I would still like someone who leans a little bit towards the defensive side of the game personally. Like, I've seen links with Gravenberch, for example. I think I'm not overly sure he does that. I think if anything, he would lean towards being a bit more of an expressive player who's attack minded and wants to play and all that. I think we need a few more players who are interested in what happens when we lose the ball and want to do the dirty work and carry the piano, basically. So I would like a midfielder along those lines. And I think we need a centre-half as well. Ideally one who's left-footed. But considering, like, Canate's injured again, Matip will probably be able to do three of those shifts where he's covering that much ground and he'll pull a hamstring or something. So I think we need a right-sided centre-half as well, really. So, but any kind of centre-half, really, for me, would be a massive benefit, I think, going into the rest of the season. But for me, it's two, I think, yeah.
Andy, what about you, mate?
Yeah, I think I agree, at least two. I've no doubt that you know, our first 11, if it stays fit and we have that kind of fairy tale season like we have in 13-14 where there are no injuries more or less, You know, that they can do that. Van Dijk and Konaté can be a title-winning centre-half partnership for me, but as Josh says, Konaté's injured again. We know what his injury record's like. And one thing that we didn't really mention in part one was the performances of Matip and Gomez. He both played very well yesterday, but again, game situation. When else are they going to come into a situation where their back's against the wall and it's okay to just sort of sit in? We need our centre-half next to Van Dijk to be able to be comfortable going out to right-back and engaging and going one-on-one and having that pace to play the high line. And I'm just not sure Matip and Gomez, the way we usually play, are capable of doing it anymore. So I definitely think we need another one there. And I agree with Josh, you know, another midfielder, absolutely. I don't mind, really, actually, if it's a 6 or an 8 or if it's defensive-minded or attacking-minded, because you know, you could sign another 8 and say, right, Bicetic, Thiago and Endo are your options at 6. And you're taking a bit of a risk there in terms of how Bicetic develops and he keeps on that upward trajectory. But, you know, I would have no issue with a Gravenberch. I think that's, you know, from what I've seen of him, albeit it was a couple of years ago, and he does seem to have had a bit of a downward spiral in his career. You know, hopefully you can just find that sweet spot where you can revive him. And, yeah, at least 2. But, yeah. I think there's going to have to be surgery in defensively next summer anyway. You're probably going to have to do another 1 or 2 there. So,
Dan, me and you have constantly heard and spoken to so many people over the course of the last 3 months about centre-halves, and we've always sat there with a perplexed look on our face when the right-sided centre-back was preferenced over right-sided centre-back was preferenced over the left-sided centre-back. Mm-hmm. Everyone seems to have swung now to left-sided centre-back.
They do, and finally, I would say I never understood right-sided centre-back. I do. We spoke about this morning, and when we kind of said a little while ago it was a 50-50 split, really, amongst the fan base about people wanting a left or a right, I never got that. For me, it was a left was a no-brainer throughout the entire time. Left-sided centre-back, left-footed centre-back. Ideally, one that can play left-back and on the left-hand side of a 2, of course. That has to be the priority, and it remains the case, of course, for me. And I think the right-sided one, and the point Josh makes, is right in terms of Konaté is the standard setter when it comes to that role. Certainly when we play the new system where Trent goes into midfield, nobody can do it like him. The problem is, of course, his injury record. I don't think he's put 10 games together for us yet, which is a huge problem in itself. And the backups to him are Matip and Gomez. But you can get through with those three, in my opinion. That's okay. It's probably more of a case of, like Andy alluded to, you can't do everything all in one window. It'd be nice to, but it's almost impossible to. We're finding that out now the hard way, of course. I think that is something you can kick down the line. For me, the left-sided one isn't, because we might be facing that reality now. With Virgil van Dijk suspended for the next game already, we're kind of scratching around for who's the ideal man to come and do that job. If we sign one, he's there, he's through the door. Now, that player, the left-sided centre-back, doesn't have to be someone who starts week in, week out, because you've got Virgil van Dijk, you've got Andy Robertson for the left-back, but you want someone who can drop into that role. Now, so much of this conversation remains based on what system Liverpool are going to play moving forwards. Now, again, yesterday, for the third time this season, we haven't seen us be able to incorporate our best system, which has meant some of our best weapons, Szoboszlai and McAllister, haven't been able to play their natural role. But most importantly, Trent hasn't been able to go into midfield and do that type of thing. Because when he does that, you know, Robertson becomes a left-sided centre-back. Now, I'm yet to have a conversation with somebody who tells me that Robertson is naturally a left-sided centre-back, because he just isn't. Therefore, for me still, I come back to the point, and again, that's why it's always baffled me that anybody in their right mind would say we need the right-sided one. You need to sign the left-sided one, because that's what Andy Robertson then becomes. And you surely want a more natural fit there. He's not 6'1", he's not 6'2". He's not a left-sided centre-back. I don't see a world whereby we can move forwards with that, personally. I love Andy Robertson, but his attributes aren't best suited to being that guy. The best off suit is similar to Nunes, in a sense, moving forwards, doing stuff in the final third, getting up and down that left-hand side, not being, I'll sit here, you go and do that stuff. That doesn't suit him.
Josh?
I completely agree, yeah. I think it's interesting how we've just let so many of these left-footed centre-halves move, though, this summer, without kind of getting involved. Like, I've been watching a bit of Spurs so far this season, and watching Mickey van der Ven.
Who we were linked with.
Yeah, who we were linked with. I think it's been really interesting just to watch him and see how differently he interprets that role compared to Robertson, because he is proper less is more, you know, black boots, passing the ball to the man next to him, passing the ball to the man next to him, doing the dirty work and then giving the ball to Son and saying, you're going to win us the game. And Robertson is still, at least 50% in that mould of Liverpool's creator, and Liverpool, you know, he's still trying Hollywood passes, and it's impacting how frantic Liverpool's game is. Klopp's touched on that a few times so far in his presses about like Liverpool being a bit too harried with the ball, a bit too rushed, need to relax, need to put our foot on it. And I think it'd help if our left-back / left-sided centre-half was just a bit less Hollywood, a bit more like, you know, less is more. And any centre-half really would be that, yeah, in comparison to the high-flying full-back that is Robertson and his nature over the past couple of years. So I agree, I think we need that kind of player, but whether we're going to get that, I still think Klopp in his head is thinking midfield. And with the window set to close in a couple of days now, I think it's ambitious to think that we're going to get two. Hopefully we will, but...
I mean, the Cecconate rumours are persisting, Andy. Would he be a player that you are comfortable with? And do you think Liverpool are really going to spend 60 or 70 million on him?
Is it Doucouré, the Palace lad? Yeah.
Did I say Cecconate then?
I think so, yeah. I was just wondering if it was a genuinely...
I think I might have typed it as well, to be honest with you. I'm pretty certain I did, yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering, I thought you'd ask me a player I'd never heard of. I have to be honest, you know, and I don't watch that much of Crystal Palace. Nothing's really particularly wowed me about him. I could be completely wrong. And, you know, I think your point, Josh, about the piano carrier, the player that comes in doesn't have to wow us. He's just someone who can sort of get it and give it, and a bit less is more, as you say, and give it to your Szoboszlais and your McAllisters and your magic men up front. But, you know, I'm not averse to getting somebody like that in, but nobody else has really been linked to him, have they? And you know, at that price, I think, because they know we have the money, because it's late in the window, because they can't replace him, I'm not sure it's something I'd be particularly buzzing about, but it's probably better than, well, it is better than nothing. It would be better.
There is a lot of people, like Chloe definitely is someone who's really high on Doucouré, isn't she, Dan? Mm-hmm. I mean, she really wants to see us sign him. I think Gravenberch is probably the one where I can put on me Liverpool owner's hat on, imagine it more.
Yeah.
Perceived value in the transfer market. Sorry to say those horrible words.
FSG hat.
Yeah. Could you not though? Am I right?
No, I agree with you. Yeah. I agree with
And plus on that, Gravenberch is actually a longer standing target. Yeah. That makes more sense. Doucouré to me would actually feel a little bit reactionary. And we've had to do that in this window because of what's happened with Fabinho and Henderson, of course, and what happened with the Caicedo and Lavia. Those forbidden words, you thought yours were forbidden. Forbidden words. We had to react and sort of bend and flex there. We went and got Endo because of that. I'm convinced that's why we went and got Endo, just because we needed someone through the door quickly. And within 24 hours, he was playing against Bournemouth. So it actually makes a lot of sense. But I don't think the Doucouré one, I'm not sure where he was on the list. Where was the Gravenberch? We know we wanted him before he moved to Bayern Munich. So, albeit he's not a six predominantly, because he's not, he's an eight. He's an eight who can actually play a little bit to 10, but has done the six. He does fit the progressive type and the multifunctional type, and the one you can add to the squad. And all of a sudden, and I think this is what it is for me, my overarching feeling on it is you're just improving your odds of having a successful season by having somebody else. Because to kind of touch on Andy's point earlier, when our best 11's out there, which we probably haven't seen yet, if truth be told, because of Canate's absence yesterday, when our best 11's out there, that best 11 can challenge in all four competitions that we're in this year. I'm certain of it. However, the minute you drop below that, the lads below it are actually okay, but there's issues with them all. Because you go to Thiago in the six, we know how injury-prone he is. Stefan Bajcetic, still relatively unproven, loads of talent, bags and bags of talent. I think he's going to be brilliant. Unproven, has just been injured. And you go through and so on and so on, Curtis Jones, injured, etc. Whereas if you add a Gravenberch, all of a sudden you've got this lad whose injury record's pretty good. You know, we know we've liked him for a long time. He's physical enough to come and do many different jobs for us. He's played in many different roles. You add in this little gem of an X factor that I think could transform the way you look at your squad depth. You know when people do them squad depth charts, people love them on Twitter, you'll be well versed in these. He suddenly fits into 3/4 of those roles if you do want to add an out and out 10, which I'm not sure we ever will. But that just changes the whole complexion of it. And I think it makes so much sense to go and do that bit of business. Doucouré, I'm not as sold on for all the reasons we mentioned. I think the fee is massively inflated. I think that's Palace And, you know, credit to them, and they should do this. It's them doubling down on the fact they don't want to sell him. It's too late in the window for them to sell him. Like we are with Salah in many ways, you know what I mean? We're not selling one of our best players now. That'd be insane.
Charlie Barry from Toffee TV has just given up at 10 past three. Very Everton, that was.
Oh, yeah, they do that a lot. And just to finish on it as well, the price tag for Doucouré is just muddied by the fact that Rice, Caicedo and Enzo Fernandez before him have all gone for crazy money. And Palace have gone, looked at that and gone, oh, you're 115, well, we'll add 20 onto ours then. That's all it is. And again, can't blame them for it. For us, I think that left-sided centre-back that I mentioned before and a multifunctional midfielder makes us a completely different proposition this season.
Josh, I think that Liverpool are going to sign Andre after the transfer window, so January. I think that Liverpool are going to go big on Gravenberch and the centre-half. And I can see them apportioning the money accordingly for that, which might leave them quite a big sum of money for the centre-half. Mm. But I'm still not sure who the centre-half is. And also, does one of these players have to be English? Because I'm sure after the Endo signing, we've only got one, or homegrown, sorry, not English, one homegrown player slot left.
Yeah,
That is a very tough place for Liverpool to be working in right now.
Yeah, I think you're right. And if that's the case, I mean, if you're already looking at centre-halves and he's got to be left-footed, that already narrows the market massively.
And homegrown.
So you don't want to add the homegrown to that. So in my opinion, you probably get the homegrown in your midfield somewhere rather than that left-footed centre-half.
Or a young player like Gravenberch, who's still technically the under-21.
Yeah. Is he?
Interesting. Yeah, he's 21. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I mean, it's a difficult puzzle isn't it, to solve, but as I said, if you need to get one of these lads in who's homegrown, for me, you don't do that with your left-footed centre-back because there's already about five of them on the continent anyway. You know, so it's difficult enough to find them. Like, so if you're adding the homegrown thing to the mix, you've got like Levi, I always call him Leroy, Levi Colwell and nobody else really.
Mark Gahey is the other one.
Yeah, yeah. Mark is he left-footed?
Yeah, Palace. Yeah.
He's just been linked to, who's he been linked to? Is it United today?
He was linked to us previously in the summer.
Yeah, I'm sure United, because they're being linked to loads of different left-backs, aren't they? And
yeah.
I think his name got through into the mix as well, to be honest.
Yeah, I think one of the frustrating things with the Doucouré thing as well, by the way, is the fact he moved 12 months ago. When we needed a midfielder, we just missed out on our top target. He goes to Palace for 18 million. Mm-hmm. The other lad who were linked with, who was on this shortlist, apparently Kamara, went to Villa for free. You know, it's so frustrating. Lavia went to... I mean, City probably wouldn't have sold Lavia anyway, but he went to Southampton for 14 million. We've been linked with all three of these this summer. Mm. And Casado, he was the only one last summer who didn't move.
And don't forget, we got offered Ronaldo. Cristiano, of course, in 2001 or something for 7 million, and Rafa didn't fancy him. So if we're going to go back there. Yeah. No, it is right, though. I mean, we've scouted all these players. That's the annoying thing.
We hesitated last summer, and we're getting punished for it now.
But, you know, three or four years ago, when we were maybe on the periphery of top four, or in the top four, and getting the Champions League every season, and trying to go up to Challenge City, we were signing these players, we were getting in before they made the stepping stone and before they became the sort of 60, 70, 80 million pound players. We, you know, we took the gamble and the Robertsons and the Wijnaldums, and maybe Shaqiri didn't work out quite as well, but or Minamino, but you took the gambles and, you know, you got them just before they were about to explode. Whereas it feels like now, because we have been challenging City at times in previous seasons, that we feel like we need to sign the finished article or close to the finished article. And, you know, we know that FSG and we know that the owners and the people in the transfer committee, they want that perfect transfer. They want, like, McAllister's 35 million is a perfect transfer for them. Mm-hmm. Soboslai, maybe a little bit more money than they would have liked to have paid, but perfect transfer, it's not that much. And, you know, the problem is, you know, this, whoever we get in at this point is not going to be perfect. They're either going to have to pay over the odds for what they need, or they're not going to quite get the finished article. But, you know, it's the reason, like, the likes of the Andre one excites me is because, you know, you could be getting the Caicedo before Caicedo's made the move to Brighton, you know, for like four or five million before he becomes the 110 million player. That's what we need to do. That's what, like, you know, for example, I think we're offered Enzo Fernandez as well. But you're obviously taking a risk on them coming out of South America. They might need a bit of time to gel, or maybe we can't give them the minutes. I'm not quite sure the way around it, but I would like to see us more shopping in that sort of market and taking a couple more risks rather than going for, you know, someone who, you know, is going to be sort of maybe 6 or 7 out of 10, but maybe like an Endo. But, you know, get someone in, nurture them, and they could be that 9, 10 out of 10 player.
Josh, I've got a super chat here from Neil O'Callaghan. I'm going to come to you on a point. So it's poor planning. a game by management similar to last year. We're left short where we play catch up to everyone else. We have the smaller squad and we have not addressed this. FSG's policies to blame. I think we've talked about quite a bit of that. But one of the things that I think I want your take on, Josh, is that, like, you know, we all know that Michael Edwards left the football club. We all know that Julian Ward left the football club. We all know that Ian Graham, who was the head of, what was his actual title?
Director of Research.
Director of Research. We know Will Spearman stepped up into that role at Liverpool now. Are these guys being listened to, and is it harder to do what Andy has said if you don't have the strong data team to lean into?
It's really difficult to know from the outside. Like, there's been question marks over, like, why Ian Graham and Edwards left both handing in resignation at the same time, essentially. And I think that one, personally, was just they've done the job and they've been there for 10 years, completed the game, and now they're getting off and they want something new or they want a break or whatever. I don't think there's too much in that, but I do think since then, since they left, David Woodvine's also left, Julian Ward's left, that was kind of FSG's edge. That was the edge that we had in the market. It was never financial for Liverpool. It was always the expertise, the nous, the smartness, being a step ahead of the curve and all that stuff. The people who were part of that team, it's now kind of being disbanded a lot, really, and it's now just kind of Klopp, Linders. Spearman's a great replacement for Graham, to be fair. But it feels very Klopp and Linders and now Klopp's mate in George Schmadke. I don't think that's that controversial to say that either, because it's pretty obvious. I think one of the interesting comments that Linders made recently, actually, I don't know if he said it in a press conference or in his book or something, but he defined Liverpool's recruitment approach as the academy and game changers. That was how he defined it, and it was never that, you know. It was never previously that when we had this team of like Edwards and all this. That was never the approach. I don't know where that's come in. As in, like, you know, we get these players from the academy and we go and sign Jude Bellingham and there's no one in between. That's a sudden change. And so it does feel like Liverpool's recruitment approach has changed a little bit in the past couple of seasons through these people leaving and Klopp gaining power and Linders gaining a bit of power. And I don't think it's been a case of, like, you know, Klopp and Linders grabbing the keys and literally saying, you know, we're in charge now or anything like that. I think it's just been more of a natural shift, as in, like, this is just kind of the way it's gone now because of the power that Klopp's got, similar to Ferguson when he was at United and that. But whether it's for the better, it's difficult to say now, because we just don't really know what the product is like at the minute of this new setup. We saw a bit of that, I think, with the Caicedo-Lavia fallout. And I think if we've got a well-oiled operation behind the scenes where everything is in place and that, I'm not sure we end up doing what we did, where we look a bit mad, bidding for Lavia three times, not getting him, bidding for Caicedo 100-odd million without agreeing personal terms and not getting him either. Then we go and get a lad who's 30 and has never played out of Germany in Europe. So yeah, that's my assessment of the whole thing. It's difficult to determine how good we are at the minute because lot's changed recruitment wise.
Listen, I've got no problem with Klopp and Linders and Schmacher doing the deals and stuff, but I think for the long term future of Liverpool, the system that we had in place better protected us when Klopp, for want of a better term, hangs up his boots.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's the difficulty of it. Like, that's the difficulty of leaning on this almighty figure who, to be fair, Klopp is in Liverpool. I mean, he literally has the keys to the city now. You know, he's that kind of figure and he's delivered the Premier League to Anfield for the first time in 30 years. So I can totally understand why FSG have potentially got to a point where it's like, Jürgen, just solve it, mate. You know, you do it. But he benefited initially at the start from having support around him. And if we're going to hope to continue to compete at the highest level when he leaves, it'd be good to have that kind of Brighton structure in place where no matter who's poached, they are just replaced as another body and that the whole kind of organisation keeps going as it was going anyway, regardless of who leaves. But we are leaning more and more on Klopp and it's worrying in terms of, like, when he does depart, does it just crumble and we have to start again from scratch?
Yeah.
He does get, they do get some things right as well, you know, Linders and Klopp in terms of the players they're targeting. Like, I know Gakpo is very much a Linders signing. I think you'll know probably Dan better than me, but I'm pretty sure he came and he said that's the one he wanted. Yeah. And you know, listen, these two are intelligent men. You know, they can identify a good player when they see one. What I suspect they don't have the time to do is sit and watch every single game across Europe's top five leagues and the South American leagues and this, that, and the other. And, you know, reading Pep Linders' book as well, I remember they said when Nunez came to Anfield, they just said, you know, if we go for a striker, we go for him. That was what Klopp said to Linders. So they do seem to have that power. And we know that from, like, previous things, you know, Salah wasn't necessarily first choice. There were a couple of others. I think we tried to sign Götze before... I think
that was Salah.
Salah and Julian Brandt.
And Brandt. Before Mane. I don't think Mane was first choice either. So, you know, that team they had behind them was so good. It was the best in the business, and it had to be the best in the business because we can't spend the money that state-owned clubs are spending. I think we should be spending more, don't get me wrong. This isn't me defending the owners in any way, shape or form. I don't think we do enough, but we know we can't do that, so we do need to be able to be the best at identifying who's that player who's just about to explode, who you can get in for sort of 30, 40, 50 million, and they're becoming a £100 million player, which we've been the experts of over the last 10 years. But my concern is just the identification of these players now. It has the brain drain of the geeks behind the scenes, for want of a better word. Is that gone now? Are we as good as identifying those players? And if we're not, then it will just become a game of money where City are spending Newcastle and Chelsea are spending twice the money that you're spending, and they're getting twice the player, because without that leveller, I think we're in a bit of trouble.
Tough. I've got a question for you, really tough question here for you from Super Chat from Aaron Garza. Sorry for being an absolute shithouse on this one.
Can't wait.
It's coming straight to you. Depending on how the rest of the window goes, yep, when would it be okay to say FSG is cheap rather than smart in the market?
Why did I know you were going to say that? I think this time next week, to be honest. I really do. I think
it's okay to say they're cheap now.
Well, no, because I like to reserve judgment while the window's still open, personally. Because if we sign the midfielder and the left-sided centre-back that I think we need and the ones I want us to sign between now and Friday's deadline, then I'd be stupid to sit here and say we've got it wrong. I think if we don't get those two players in, we will have left ourselves short to sort of talk about what I went on about earlier in terms of, I think we just improve our odds of having a successful season massively by signing those two players. At the minute, it's a huge gamble, and it's gambles that we've took before. Obviously, the COVID season, we lost all our centre-halves, and last season when we were short on midfielders, we've taken those gambles, they've backfired dramatically and they haven't worked. We can't do it again, in my opinion. We can't take another gamble and leave our squad short on numbers, quality, whatever else. If we're sat here this time next week, it will be a really disappointing window. And FSG will have underinvested in us. They won't give us enough money. But the problem with that is, and it's eating away at the back of my mind, is they clearly felt like Caicedo was worth the money. And he was the answer, wasn't it? Yeah. I don't know how much of a red herring that is, I will say, because that 111 million, I've had it said to me before that they were willing to spend that because it was Caicedo.
Yeah.
There's not necessarily that money in the budget, and we're not going to see or spend that. We should do, in my opinion, because that money clearly exists somewhere because we were willing to spend it on a lad from Brighton. So, some people will see that now as the benchmark. I think we're going to in a minute, so I won't go too much into detail, but some people see that as we have to spend that money. I'm not entirely sure that's the case, but we do have money to spend, and therefore if it's Klopp or if it's Schmadko, whoever else, sort of looking at the rest of the market and saying don't want him because of X reasons, or almost like we can't get him out of there because they don't want to sell him, whatever, then you'd understand that. But I honestly believe, and I'm not one to say this sort of thing very often, but I think if we're sat here next week and we haven't been able to sign the footballer, then huge questions will have to be asked about what exactly we're doing, whether it be from the top or whether it be from the likes of Klopp, Schmadko and Linders, because something's gone wrong there. Because whoever's seen our situation and seen our squad and gone, that's fine, they're wrong. They'd be absolutely wrong. And I just want to touch on something Josh said earlier, and he's right. Because Jurgen Klopp always heralded the fact that he had the best in class around him. He lauded Michael Edwards for his role in the success and stuff like that. And Julian Ward when he was there at the time as well, in terms of them two as a partnership. Not necessarily Julian Ward's tenure as a solo, because that didn't really happen, did it, to be honest. But I wonder now, does Klopp want all this power? Like, does he want to be the guy making all the decisions? Because he was so enamoured with the fact that he had all these brilliant people around him, the best in class, making all these decisions. And they were working as a team to get things right. He almost... he almost reluctantly took some of the praise, but now all of a sudden it's like, oh, go on, Jürgen, you sort it. It feels mad to me.
I've got a theory on this. It might be complete bullshit and whatever, but like, if you have the best in class and they leave, and then it's not best in class, you might do something about it. So what I mean by that is, if you've worked with Julian Ward for a few years, but he's never been the guy, and you've worked with Ian Graham for years, but then the next guy steps up and he's not best in class because he's not Ian Graham, and Julian Ward's not best in class because he's not Michael Edwards, you might then go, actually, well, I'm not working with the best in class anymore. It's not an easy thing to talk about and stuff, but he might just think they're not as good.
Yeah, possibly, but I don't know. I think we have to get back to, again, to riff off what the lads are saying, we have to get back to being that way about it and sort of getting our behind-the-scenes recruitment in place, because Brighton are the absolute perfect example of this. They've lost countless footballers in recent times, including one they've just done. Obviously, the result at the weekend didn't go to plan, but they're going to be no worse off losing Caicedo, it looks like. They're just going to go again.
And same as when they lost Bissouma.
And more to the point, in my opinion, this is kind of the more poignant point when it comes to us and Klopp and stuff. When they lost Graham Potter, it didn't matter.
Yeah,
they had the management set up to go and get deserving.
The thing is, when Liverpool started to lose these key figures, that was the narrative that came out. That was the line that, like, the Liverpool beat was given. As in, like, it doesn't matter, you know, even if Klopp leaves or whatever, the big thing is that the infrastructure is in place. That was the line. And that's no longer there. Yes. That's no longer there. A lot of the people have left, so they can't now push that line. So is there now an expectation, is there now an onus on FSG to rebuild that? Or is this new Liverpool Reloaded that Klopp's referenced a completely different structure, not only on the pitch, but off the pitch as well, and behind the scenes? Going back to the FSG stuff, like, one of the things I've always found frustrating is, and I'll probably get pelters for this, but there's always been this narrative that Klopp is locked away in a bathroom crying his eyes out because FSG won't fund him. And for a lot of it, right, that might be the case, but I also think you can throw in there's been a lot of transfer decisions that have been footballing decisions inside the Liverpool recruitment room, and who's determining whether we should or shouldn't move. Like, say, for example, last summer when we didn't get Tchouaméni, that seemed like a Klopp decision to keep Milner, give Milner a new contract. We go and get Nunes instead, or dedicate the money there or whatever. We can go again with the midfield because I like Henderson, I like Milner, I want them to stay around. And that felt to me like a footballing decision. Even though we bid whatever it was, 60 million for Tchouaméni or whatever, we just kind of kept hold of that. Same with Bellingham. We had the money there for Bellingham, didn't get him. We still apparently got that there by the looks of it. We've just tried to bid 100 not for Caicedo. So I'm not saying the owners are funding Liverpool to an acceptable level by any means, because I do think they need to put more in. But in terms of every footballing decision, every transfer decision, I just wonder how much of it is FSG not covering up the dough, how much of it is a footballing decision inside the room where Klopp's like, no, we need to keep a path open for Bezetic, or, you know, no, we need to let... Because people were calling for, like, a right-back, for example, when Trent was still 18. You know, people were still calling for a striker when Firmino was still getting to grips with the 9 shirt because he's not a proper goal scorer and all that. So I just wonder over the years how much, and especially now, how much of it's a footballing decision, how much of it is we can't afford them.
I think it's a strategy that possibly just doesn't work when there's state-owned clubs running around with an unlimited pot of money. You know, our strategy beforehand worked well, but now you're at the point where if we're going to improve, we do need to buy ready-made players. And, you know, they feel like they, rightly or wrongly, they feel like they can't do the Robertsons, the Wijnaldums, and those players that you're taking a little bit of a gamble on, but hopefully they're about to explode. Sort of thing, they don't really know what they are. Are we the Brighton who get those players in, or, you know, are we the Man City who only buy in proven players? The problem is, if you buy the proven players, you have to, more or less most of the time, unless you get a glory deal like McAllister, you have to cough up the money for it. And on the 111 million, I don't think they, you know, they have to go out and spend every penny of that 111 million because it's there. But what I do think, it now removes their right to say to Jurgen Klopp is, you know, say Jurgen does want Doucouré and they value him at 60 million and Palace say 80, I don't think you can leave us short then. I think you have to suck it up because the strategy's just been so wrong.
My thing with the 111 million thing is, and with Liverpool's strategy all summer long, and I've said this on various shows, is they've got it wrong whether they sign the players in the next week or not for me. And that, I think that's pertinent, is you can buy the centre half and you can buy the DM now or another midfielder. You should have done it fucking 2 months ago. That's the, you have not given Liverpool the best foundation for success this season. And that's, that I don't think, listen, it might be FSG, it might be the football and people. I'm not trying to pin it on anybody. Liverpool, all-encompassing Liverpool, have got it wrong. Because they didn't sign the players to give Klopp on the 1st of July when they go back into training. Yeah. That's what the problem was last summer. We didn't get the players in that we needed to get in. We're repeating the mistakes this summer. That is really hard to get over as far as I'm concerned. And I'm like you, I don't think it is particularly easy to run a buy to sell, a sell to buy model when you stop selling players. I don't think you can fucking do it. You've got to sell your Mo Salahs for 150 million quid. You've got to sell your Fabinhos for 40 million quid when the offer comes in, whether it's high enough or it's not high enough. But you can't let it disrupt your season. And that's what Liverpool have done this year for me. And, you know, we might try into absolute world beaters and I look like a tit, but it still wouldn't have been the best foundations for success as far as I'm concerned. My laptop's about to die here because we've waffled on for so long, so I'm just going to quickly talk about Piero Hincapié because there seems to be a lot of talk about the Leverkusen centre-half now. Dan, is this a signing that you think that Liverpool should move for?
In terms of profile, yes, 100%. I'm not going to sit here and profess to know everything about the lad, but I've had some decent conversations about, I spoke to Kevin Hatchard about him last week, and he was a big fan, actually. He said you get all the usual sort of weaknesses and flaws that you get with a young defender. You know, he's only 21. He's played a decent amount of footy for somebody so young, but what
is... So he'd fit into the non-home ground as well.
Yeah, he's actually got 27 Ecuador caps, which is fascinating to me at that age. But what was interesting, most interesting about him is the fact that obviously he's by Leverkusen, Xavi Alonso, but he's played almost a 50-50 split of left-back and centre-back. And that, to me, is probably the most appealing thing. Like, the minute I seen that, I was like, okay, where does he sign? But in terms of his ability and in terms of what he offers, he was actually quite complimentary. He said he's good on the ball. He can offer that sort of thing. He's not an Andy Robertson, which I actually think is a bonus for what we're looking for, quite frankly. He's a bit more simplistic in what he tries to do with a footy. He's aggressive in the tackle. He'll go and win balls. He's quite physical, quite dominant. He's very athletic. So in terms of profile, yes, he ticks a lot of boxes. What I didn't like so much from the conversations I had over the weekend was the fact that Leverkusen want like 70 million euros for him. That was a little bit eye-opening. But that, again, and it kind of reference to what you're talking about a second ago in terms of leaving it too late, it's because it's so late in the window. Yep. Leverkusen and Xavi Alonso have made plans, Europa League plans, to have him part of their team. So us going knocking on doors now, we're going to get teams turning around and adding money onto it because that's where we're at.
It's hard to swallow, to be honest with you, isn't it? So there you go. I think that we've kind of wrapped up the Liverpool transfer side of things. We've kind of said the players that we want. So most people just want a centre midfielder and a centre back. We've obviously done the Newcastle game. We're going to be doing the biased football podcast over on Red Men Plus now. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me on Originals. It's been an absolute pleasure. We'll see you next time. Don't forget to like the video and follow the guys on Twitter as well. Cheers.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.